Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Can you come up with one year in cinema history that Hollywood really got it right? Maybe 1939, the year that The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, and Stagecoach were released. Yeah, 1939 may have been a very good year for movies, but writer Brian Raftery argues that 1999 was even better. He makes the case in his book, Best Movie Year Ever, how 1999 blew up the big screen.
It's kind of a ridiculous list, and so much so that I actually had a friend who for a couple years had a party trick where he would try to get people to name all the hit movies of that year, and no one could ever get all of them. But the big ones really are, you can start with The Matrix, you have Fight Club, Sixth Sense, Blair Witch Project, Being John Malkovich, Election, and those are some of the big sort of critical hits. You also have Office Space, which was not a hit that year but became a big cult phenom.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
Good one.
Oh, that's terrific, Peter.
You have The Phantom Menace, which was not the greatest movie of 1999, but with the exception of Titanic, was absolutely the biggest movie of the 90s. And you also have all these interesting kind of subsets. Like, you know, Notting Hill is really one of the seminal romantic comedies of the 90s. Yeah. You have a bunch of teen movies like American Pie and She's All That and Varsity Blues that were huge hits in their own right. So it's a very varied year. I think I cover about 30 movies in the book, mm-hmm. and I had to cut at least 10 to 15, I think, that I really wanted to get into.
Yeah. You could easily do a sequel. A couple of sequels, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. What do you think was going on in Hollywood in the late 90s that allowed so many great movies to be released in this one year?
Some of it's circumstance. Obviously, movies take years to develop. And some of these films, like The Matrix or Boys Don't Cry, had been in the works, you know, throughout most of the mid-90s. So in some ways, it's a little bit of a coincidence. But I also think it was a sort of a collision. I mean, if you look at the movies of that year, you have a lot of filmmakers, veteran filmmakers like Stanley Kubrick or George Lucas coming back after big stretches. You have a lot of filmmakers who had kind of made names for themselves in the 80s and 90s like David Fincher and Michael Mann getting a chance to make movies. But you also had this remarkable crop of first-time filmmakers. And if you look at the list of first-time directors that year, you have Brad Bird making The Iron Giant. Mm-hmm. You have Spike Jonze making Being John Malkovich. You have Sofia Coppola making The Virgin Suicides and on. So there was this generational kind of overlap, and it all happened in a period when Hollywood really needed some new ideas. The late 90s were really full of a lot of dying franchises. They were full of a lot of TV adaptations that didn't do well. So the studios, I think, recognized that there was a lot of excitement and momentum in the world of independent film, in the world of music videos, in the world of TV commercials, and pulled from all these different places. And all these people had a story they'd been wanting to tell for a long time.
Yeah, and as you say in your book, so many of these films were ahead of their time, and their themes are still relevant today. How did that happen?
You know, I thought about that a lot, about why, you know, these movies have a lot of common themes. And one of the really big themes is identity, this idea of, you know, who am I? Could I be someone else? Is there a way of changing my life?
The funny thing is I'm not pretending to be somebody else, and you are.
And that's a theme in almost all of these movies. I mean, it's Cameron Diaz's character and Being John Malkovich. It's, the guys in Office Space wanting to escape their life. It's Keanu Reeves in The Matrix and Edward Norton in Fight Club wanting to escape these sort of doldrums. And I think, you know, there's two big reasons for that, I think. One is that this was just a slightly more navel-gazy time in America. I mean, this was pre-9/11, and the world felt a little more comfortable, and I think a lot of people were sort of stepping back and saying, okay, here's this thing coming up on the horizon. And that was the other thing, which was Y2K. And so there was this big deadline. And I think people, whether they could articulate it or realize at the time, I think Y2K and the new millennium was sort of this sort of subconscious deadline where it's like, we're really speeding into the future. Am I caught up? Am I who I need to be in this new world? And that idea, whether it was articulated or not, that sort of runs through these films, and it kind of gives them an electricity and a relevance that I think has kept them in the conversation, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah, for sure. As you say, storytelling was itself in the middle of a mutation. How did 1999 movies reinvent narratives?
I think, you know, one of the other directors who kind of made their name that year was Christopher Nolan, who in 1998, he'd put out this really cool black and white thriller called Following, and 1999 was the year he brought it to America. And that was a movie that I really recommend readers watch it if they haven't seen it. It's 70 minutes long. It's his first real movie. It's really crisp and smart, but it really plays with time, as a lot of movies did that year. Run, Lola, Run kind of broke up the narrative and pulled stories out of order. And I think, you know, Christopher Nolan's theory, and I think he's a guy who knows a lot about why about movie rhythms and structure. You know, his theory is that by the end of the 90s, you know, people had come to terms with movies being on video and being on DVD, and you could pause something and you could dive back in and rewatch. You could, you know, you could watch a movie out of order on DVD if you wanted to. So while a lot of films had clearly played with narrative structures, in 1999 you see these movies where a lot of narrative laws are being entirely, you know, either thrown away or rewritten. I mean, look at The Blair Witch Project. That's a movie that's, you know, shot by these actors in the middle of the woods. It's a movie with the setup is so minimal. You're just watching them and what they see through their camera.
I'm scared to close my eyes. I'm scared to open them. I'm gonna die out of here.
A lot of big sort of story beats in that movie are just not explained because you just, after a decade of shows like Cops, people were so used to kind of the idea of found footage and someone mounting a camera on their shoulder and following them around. So there was a lot of really interesting experimental ideas and movies that went mainstream in a big way that year.
Yeah, and also the success of Quentin Tarantino's 1994 film Pulp Fiction, which
absolutely
really played with timelines, probably had something
to
do with it as well, right?
Oh, I think so. I think that movie loomed over a lot of the end of the 90s. People wanted, you know, and that's another reason why this year happened. Big studios wanted the next Pulp Fiction. They wanted a movie that had that momentum and that cultural currency, and you had to turn to new filmmakers to try to find something like that.
Look, I'm not paying you to do whatever it is you're doing out here.
Fine. So don't pay me.
Excuse me?
I quit. So you don't have to pay me. Now leave me alone.
I think you just became my personal hero.
As you point out, a lot of the 1999 movies explored white-collar dissatisfaction. For example, mm-hmm. Office Space, American Beauty, and Fight Club. And Fight Club, I think, is one of the standout films from 1999. It's certainly one of my favorites, and I hope that you're okay with talking about it.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
Those listeners who haven't seen Fight Club, can you give us a brief synopsis of it?
Well, unfortunately, the first rule of Fight Club is that you can't talk about Fight Club. So,
break the rules.
I don't want to. It's weird. It's a 20-year-old movie. I don't want to ruin it for people, but you know what? It's 20 years old. So, and it's based on Chuck Palahniuk's book. And it's a very, you know, this movie came out in the fall of 1999. It was David Fincher, a remarkable filmmaker, given a huge budget. He's given these two huge stars. Edward Norton was a huge, you know, he was sort of seen as our generation's Dustin Hoffman at that point, this amazing, charismatic character actor. And you have Brad Pitt, and they're making a movie that either you think is very funny or you find deeply nihilist. Yeah. And it came out right after, just a few months after Columbine, and it's a very provocative film. It's a very disturbing movie, and I love it too, though interestingly, it's not, maybe not for the reasons it was made. I actually never kind of related to the movie's, you know, hang-ups on masculinity, but I really think it says a lot that this was a movie that was calling out consumer culture and our love of brands and the way we so willingly turn our lives over to these big products, you know, just a few years before we all started carrying iPhones and iPods in our pockets and started swearing our allegiance to big companies and their social media feeds. To me, that movie really captures just how much of the corporate, how much our corporate overlords were going to be kind of moving in on us in the 21st century.
Like so many others, I had become a slave to the IKEA nesting instinct.
Yes, I'd like to order the Erica Picari dust ruffles.
Please hold.
I'd flip through catalogs and wonder what kind of dining set defines me as a person. I had it all. Even the glass dishes with tiny bubbles and imperfections, proof that they were crafted by the honest, simple, hardworking indigenous peoples of wherever.
I was holding.
Yeah, and it wasn't a box office hit, and it got a lot of criticism, didn't it? And a lot of critics responded really negatively to Fight Club.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think some of them have changed their mind. I do think it's important to remember that this was a movie that was supposed to come out in the summer of 99. It got pushed back a few months because of Columbine, but I don't think that when it arrived that fall, I don't think Columbine was any less fresh in people's minds. And I think, you can sort of look at the, you know, this was also only a couple years after Oklahoma City and the first World Trade Center bombing. And this was a movie about, you know, urban terrorism that was also having a lot of, was also disarmingly funny at times. And I think I remember seeing it on opening weekend and standing up at the end on a Friday night, seeing it in Manhattan Theater and turning to my friend and just being like, that was too much. Like, that was great. But I felt really pummeled by that movie in the same way that David Fincher's Seven really pummeled me, where I couldn't wash that movie off me, either one of these movies off me, for a couple of days afterward, which isn't what people go to the movies for sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the movies released in 1999 explore identity and the desire that we have to be someone else, and these are ideas that are still a big part of our culture these days, maybe even more so these days. But what's your take on Spike Jonze's Being John Malkovich?
I love it. I mean, I remember, it's another movie that I remember very clearly, very vividly seeing and being really wowed by. And that movie, along with Three Kings, I know for sure that I took friends to see it the next week. I was like, you've got to see this movie. And, you know, for those who've forgotten the setup, it's, you know, John Cusack plays this very sad sack puppeteer who discovers behind a filing cabinet a portal that will allow you to enter John Malkovich's brain for 15 minutes. And he and his wife, who's played by Cameron Diaz, and Catherine Keener, who's this kind of opportunistic businesswoman, start charging people to go into John Malkovich's brain.
Mr. Malkovich, I think I can explain.
Yeah, explain.
My name is Craig Schwartz, and we operate a little business here that simulates for our clientele, well, the experience of being you, actually.
Simulate?
Yeah, after a fashion.
What exactly does that mean?
Well, it's hard to describe.
I want to do it, then.
I'm sure that would pale in comparison to the actual experience.
I want to do it!
It's an interesting movie in that, along with Boys Don't Cry, it talks a little bit about being transgender and is trying to address that in way before that was something we were all talking about more frequently. But to me, that movie is sort of a very... either a very early warning or a very stark prediction of what was going on with the internet. Because the whole movie is about how you can take over someone's identity and how easy and desirable that is. And to me, I feel like this whole idea of hijacking someone's identity and stealing their life, you can see a lot of that, what's played out now online every day in the early seeds of it and being John Malkovich.
Yeah, that's very true. Very good point. And you mentioned Three Kings. Talk a bit about that film.
That's absolutely, I keep saying these movies are my top five or top ten. That's absolutely, I think it's the most underrated movie of that year. For me, that movie was kind of my Matrix. When I saw that, I was just absolutely blown away by it. It was directed by David O. Russell, who has gone on to make a lot of movies like The Fighter. But this was after he had just made two really smart but very kind of outre indie comedies. And Warner Brothers said, what do you want to do? And they gave this young filmmaker, you know, excess of $50 million to go to the Arizona desert with George Clooney, who was then absolutely one of the biggest stars in the world because of ER.
Yeah.
And he makes this movie about these military guys who are in the Persian Gulf War. It's over. And they decide to try to steal some gold. And they slowly, over the course of some really remarkable action scenes, slowly start realizing the price of war and the roles they played in it. And it's funny. It's very jarring. It's a deeply, I mean, David O. Russell, he's one of the people I interviewed for the book.
Yeah.
And he was very much getting nervous about gun culture at that time in the late 90s. And he wrote it as sort of a meditation on gun violence.
The worst thing about a gunshot wound, provided that you survived the bullet, is something called sepsis.
Infection of the blood.
That's right. Say a bullet tears into your gut. Creates a cavity of dead tissue. That cavity, it fills up with bile. Bacteria.
It's a shocking scene, and it was a shocking scene to watch again, you know, right after Columbine. We'd had this massive loss of life from gun violence, and I think that movie is very prophetic, and it's also a movie that I don't think a studio would make anymore. It's very risky, it's very expensive, and there's too much to lose on a movie like Three Kings nowadays.
Besides Three Kings, is there another one that you would recommend to our listeners that, oh, you really should see this film?
Yes, everyone should see American Movie. Not American Beauty, which you can see if you want, but American Movie, which I did not have as much room for in the book as I would have liked, is a fantastic documentary about a Midwest filmmaker trying to make a low-budget horror movie.
You know, these are the vistas right here. And what does it feel like to have a couple rusty cars parked right against a rusty background? Because this is really fall and winter when the earth decays and the cars have decayed and these guys are decaying, you know? And that's what it's all about, rust and decay.
It's absolutely one of the best movies that year. It's very poignant, it's very smart, it's very funny. And I think it captures all of the excitement of 90s independent filmmaking in one two-hour movie. It's remarkable.
What were you like before all this? Were you like me, like a girl?
Yeah.
Like a long time ago. And then I guess I was just like a boy. And I was just a jerk.
There were a couple, at least a couple of great films made by women in 1999, released in 1999. Kimberly Pierce's Boys Don't Cry, which you mentioned earlier, and Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. And you talked to Allison Anders, another female filmmaker, and she co-wrote and co-directed Sugartown, which was released in 1999. Mm-hmm. What did she tell you about how 1999 was as a year for women filmmakers?
You know, she was very honest, and she said this was, you know, at that point, after the sort of 90s indie explosion, which was a lot more inclusive, I think, than Hollywood was. When you look at the movies that were winning at Sundance in the early 90s to mid-90s, there were a lot of female filmmakers, there were a lot of LGBTQ filmmakers, and I don't think those filmmakers got the same opportunities as women did. And she said, you know, this was a great if you're a guy.
Yeah.
But the women were already kind of being written out of that history at that point. And I think it's true. And I think you can certainly see some really remarkable female filmmakers. I think, you know, the two female writers who wrote 10 Things I Hate About You, which is a really cool and absolutely beloved teen movie. There's a lot in Julia Stiles' character that's fantastic. And I think Run Lola Run, which has a female protagonist, is a remarkable movie, one of the best of that year. But certainly, it is the proportion of movies about men and women is way off. And the proportion of films written and directed and about people of color and LGBTQ members, filmmakers, is way off. And I think it's a question that we are asking a lot more in 2019 that we should have been asking in 1999.
And so we started to learn about their lives, coming to hold collective memories of times we hadn't experienced. We felt the imprisonment of being a girl, the way it made your mind active and dreamy, and how you ended up knowing what colors went together. We knew that the girls were really women in disguise, that they understood love and even death, and that our job was merely to create the noise that seemed to fascinate them. We knew that they knew everything about us and that we couldn't fathom them at all.
You have this great quote from the actor, writer, and director Todd Field at the end of your book. Field told you that in 1999, we were passionate about seeing film as a way to enlarge our collective consciousness. Nowadays, it seems that we see film as a way to shrink our collective consciousness. What happened?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to look at it's very hard to understand sort of what's happened in the last 20 years to the film industry and to film going. I mean, because there are so many factors. Obviously, you know, in 1999, The Sopranos debuted, The West Wing debuted, Jon Stewart took over The Daily Show. There were a lot of monumental moments in television. And television soon started kind of taking over the culture and taking a lot of that cultural space. But I do think there's something shifting in why people go to the movies. Because in 2019, you don't necessarily have to go to the movies. You can watch things on Netflix. You can watch it on Amazon. You can wait 3 months until the latest movie is streaming. And so I think there's a little bit of a feeling that, well, I'm only going to go to the theater if I kind of know what I'm getting. And I understand that. You know, I mean, it's movie going is expensive, and the movie going experience is not always great for people who don't live near fancy theaters where they ask people to turn off their phones. You know, so you're asking people to pay a lot. And so you want to see a movie that you kind of already know what's going to happen. Whereas I think in 1999, I think a lot of the filmmakers and the studios were really kind of interested in reflecting the world that was out there. And, you know, Steven Soderbergh also talks in the book a little bit about what 9/11 did to our desires from art. And, you know, and he points out that movies have always been a form of escapism. They're even more of a form of escapism now. And I do think we are still wrestling with how 9/11 changed what we want to see on screen. But certainly, if you look at 20 years ago, where these movies were really kind of grappled with real, real, real deep issues like identity and death and oppression and bigotry and a lot of interesting ideas, you know, a lot of the movies now are superheroes and zombie movies. They're movies about immortality, and they're not really quite some of them aren't looking quite as deep as to where we are. That said, there's a lot of franchise movies I love. I loved Black Panther. I love Blade Runner 2049. I love The Last Jedi, which some people find a very controversial opinion, I guess. But, I get a lot of delight from big, ambitious, big-budget blockbuster movies. I just wish we could sneak in a few more being John Malkovich's or Eyes Wide Shut's or Elections in there along the way.
Get more out of life. Go out to a movie.
Brian Raftery is the author of Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. You can find out more about Brian on our website, wpr.org/beta. What are your favorite films from 1999? Or do you think that there was even a better year for film? Let us know by sending an email to beta@wpr.org or send us a tweet @WPRBeta.
I was so focused on making this cheesecake. And at that moment, I'd never done anything like that. I never have been as focused on anything. At that moment, I was like, this is what I need to be doing.
Top Chef contestant Kwame Onwuachi on the moment he decided to become a chef. That's coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.